The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Hillsdale understands the importance of education to the future of our country, and they want you to as well. So they are offering you 10 free print copies of the recent issue of Imprimis, entitled Education is a Battleground, written by Hillsdale College President Larry Arndt. The special issue of Imprimis provides a factual account of the issues in the ongoing battle over education, explains why parents and teachers, not bureaucrats and activists, should guide what our children are learning. Don't miss the opportunity to arm yourself with the facts. Claim your free copies, 10 of them. Education is a Battleground, the Imprimis issue you cannot miss, by visiting hughforhillsdale.com. That's hughforhillsdale.com. Act now and join the battle over education for our country's future. Take it away, my friend.
Thank you, Hugh. Yes, Week of Dwayne continues. It's day two. Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. My name is Dwayne Patterson, the producer of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Good to have you here. Lots ahead in the program today. We're going to have conversations with David Drucker of the Dispatch a little bit later in this hour. Byron York is going to be along from the Washington Examiner. Admiral James Stavridis, retired admiral, who you know him, you love him from the Carlyle Group. There's lots to talk about with him, both in Ukraine and a couple of very important pieces about our state of readiness in case we do have a conflict with China. We will talk with Admiral Stav about that a little later in the program. Bethany Mandel will be along. Today is book launch day for her, Stolen Youth. We will be discussing that with her a little bit later in the program. Molly Hemingway will be along from The Federalist, and there's lots of media that she is going to comment on that is just cringeworthy. That's going to be a fun conversation. And then rounding out the program will be Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton with all sorts of interesting things that he wants to discuss. But let's do the rundown, since that's kind of what Hugh likes to do around here to start the program. Prime Minister in Great Britain, Rishi Sunak, has come out and vowed to deport all illegal immigrants. "You will not be allowed to stay," Sunak says. He warned illegal immigrants entering the country that they would be deported and will not be able to stay on Sunday. He made the vow in an interview as the UK faces a steady flow of migrants crossing its borders from Europe. Sunak's government is expected to push legislation cracking down on illegal immigration later this week, with a special emphasis on illegal immigrants arriving in boats across the English Channel. Quote, "Make no mistake. If you come here illegally, you will not be able to stay," end quote, Sunak told UK media. Meanwhile, here in the United States on the southern border, we don't really know what the policy is because there really isn't one. It's kind of hard to get people in the administration to defend U.S. policy because there really hasn't been one that's been articulated. All we've heard out of the White House press team is that whatever the policy is, it's working splendiferous. Eileen Sullivan and Zolan Cano Youngs in the New York Times writes today that the U.S. is now said to consider reinstating detention of migrant families. And I looked at that and went, huh, I seem to remember a period of time not too terribly long ago where detaining families at the border was bad. We weren't supposed to be doing that. That was inhuman. That was cruel. We can't have that. And even though we're being told by voices out of the administration that border crossings are down, we're finally getting a handle on this. We're not. The numbers of apprehensions still are north of 150,000 a month, month after month after month. It's an invasion, not a problem. But now the U.S. is deciding, you know, maybe we should actually detain them after all. How well do you think that's going to go over with the civil liberty types? Look, it reminds me, every time I see a story like this, it reminds me of what Food for the Poor does, and part of the reason why we do what we do every year for Food for the Poor. They help out people in all sorts of pockets around the world. We are specifically focusing on communities in Guatemala, one of the primary countries of origin that starts this flow of migration north. Primarily because they don't have any food, they don't have water, they don't have any opportunity there. And Food for the Poor, you may be one of those types that says, we should be spending our money here. We've got problems here to worry about. Well, part of that problem is on the border. And every dollar that is spent helping people in Guatemala to have food and water and shelter, they will stay there. They won't have to make that trek north. They won't have to get into the hands of the coyotes. They won't have to be part of a sex trafficking ring. They won't have to cross the border illegally and some of them not make it in the trek across. There's lots of good that happens if you treat the problem at the source, which is what Food for the Poor does. Here is Yolanda, a mother speaking through an interpreter about what happens when Food for the Poor comes to the rescue.
Right now, they are hungry. They want food, and we don't have enough to get to the whole week. It made me feel sad. Sometimes I get in my room by myself and I cry. I wonder how can I make their life better in order to give them food. I don't want my sons and my daughters to suffer.
We don't want them to suffer. We don't want them to have to eventually make a trek out of desperation across some really bad country and fall into the hands of an opportunistic cartel and risk death, risk child trafficking, all sorts of bad things that happen. Look, you can help. You can help. Today, right now, 855-359-HOPE. That's 855-359-4673. There's a banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. If you just wait a little bit, it'll load. It helps in some browsers better than others, but it's at the top of HughHewitt.com. Thousands of you have already clicked on that banner and helped out. We would love to have more. HughHewitt.com is where the banner's at, 855-359-HOPE. Back to the rundown. I also seem to recall, not too long ago, that the media was telling us by way of the Federal Bureau of Investigations that they were advised that radical traditional Catholics were the problem. They were the extremists. They were the ones you got to worry about. If you're going to have a violent attack on American soil, it was probably going to be these Latin Mass type Catholics, right? Of course, it was nonsense. And the FBI got a black eye over this. And Christopher Wray said, well, that's not supposed to be happening. But what it turns out is they were being fed this to launch these investigations by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which itself is an extremist group by any definition of the word. But the media didn't really point too much at the Southern Poverty Law Center. In fact, they are in the news again, kinda, depends where you look. Why? Because yesterday, New York Times writes, hundreds of activists breached the site of a proposed police and fire training center in Atlanta's wooded outskirts on Sunday, burning police and construction vehicles and a trailer and setting off fireworks toward officers stationed nearby. Now, if you're going to attack a police training center and depot, protesters and activists would not be the words I would use. They would be domestic terrorists. That would be a better thing to use. And the fun part about this story, why one of the people detained, there was 23 people arrested, one of them happened to be a staff attorney for the aforementioned Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, the SPLC said, oh, he was just an observer. He wasn't really that much of an active participant. He was there. And how many of you would say, you know, just for giggles, let's go down and watch the police depot burn just as an observer so we can report on it fairly from the Southern Poverty Law Center as an attorney? I'm not buying it. The fun part, the media did what media does. Here is CBS Evening News' Nora O'Donnell covering the story last night. Cut 24, Jacob.
Tonight, 23 people are charged with domestic terrorism after a violent protest at the site of a planned police and fire training facility near Atlanta. Activists dressed all in black attacked the construction site and officers late Sunday with fireworks, Molotov cocktails, rocks, and bricks. The police chief says many of those arrested were from outside Atlanta, and their goal was anarchy.
Did you hear Nora say anywhere in there that one of those was from the Southern Poverty Law Center who was in the news for attacking and casting aspersions upon radical traditional Latin mass Catholics? No, you didn't hear that. Here is World News Tonight. Quickly, cut 25.
And tonight, some protesters accusing police in this latest incident of violating civil rights, saying in part that this, quote, reaffirms that this cop training facility should never be built.
Stop. So the problem isn't the fact that people attacked it. The problem is that the training center existed to begin with, is World News Tonight's spin. Nothing about the Southern Poverty Law Center lawyer that got detained there. But that's media. They're garbage right now. Dwayne Patterson in for Hugh. More right after the break. Good to have you here. Welcome back, America. Dwayne Patterson filling in for Hugh this week, and that music means we are joined by David M. Drucker of The Dispatch, the author of In Trump's Shadow, which, if I'm not mistaken, David, I think that's now in paperback, is it not?
Correct. Available in paperback.
Available in paperback, In Trump's Shadow. And speaking of In Trump's Shadow, I want to bring up a little bit of what Chris Christie had to say on the This Week program on Sunday, where he noted Trump's appearance at CPAC. And I don't want to get into all the problems with CPAC necessarily, but even within the CPAC room, apparently Trump as the keynote address in his room, he still only commanded a half full crowd, and that's something to me. That's like saying that Bill Shatner only gets a half full room at a Star Trek convention, David.
Yeah, that's really something. Look, the room was half full all week. It was the first time CPAC had returned to the Gaylord in National Harbor, Maryland, just across the Potomac River from Washington, since 2020, right? So since the onset of COVID, they had been in Florida for a couple of years. Attendance had been robust. This year, it didn't really matter who was in the room, whether the crowd liked who was in the room or didn't necessarily like who was in the room, whether you were a Trump-era Republican or perceived as a Republican from the before times. It was just half full. I think a lot of that might have to do with the fact that CPAC has evolved, at least for now, into a celebration of Trump and not a celebration of conservatism. Now, obviously, Trump is very popular on the right and among grassroots Republicans, maybe among the most popular, maybe some competition there with Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and a few others. But I think it's where CPAC used to be about sort of discussing movement conservatism writ large and seeing all sorts of Republicans that you really like, it's really become a Trump show. So I think some of the crowd may have to do something with the fact that CPAC itself was having some issues. I think the other part of it, Dwayne, and we're going to have to see how the Trump campaign really unfolds in the coming months, is Trump is not the same figure he was in 2015. He announces for president in June of 2015. He's a politician that the United States has really never seen before, at least in several decades. And all of his rallies, he puts on a show, but it's also new. And he's the ultimate change agent, saying for the first time certain things in certain ways that hadn't been said before. And now, look, the American people have seen the show time and time again, including the people that support him. So one, maybe that means some people are tired of it. But two, it could be that some people are not, but just don't feel the need to show up. They'll still pull the lever for him. These are things we're going to learn in the coming months.
Oh, he is definitely still by far the most compelling force of nature in American politics. I mean, love him or hate him, he just is. But what Christie was suggesting is that another physical law applies, which is the law of diminishing returns. At some point, we just kind of get over that and we start going to the next new shiny object, right?
Well, I think that's a part of it and sort of what I was getting at here. We don't quite know how this primary is going to work, but it'll be interesting to see if Governor DeSantis gets into the race, if Mike Pompeo gets into the race, what this primary competition looks like for Trump. He had the benefit in 2016, and I go back to that one because it was the last time he was a non-office holder in an open primary for the Republican nomination, if you will, right? 2020, he's the incumbent, sure. He's the president, it's different. He had the benefit in 2016 of running against a whole host of Republicans that one way or the other, a lot of Republican primary voters were tired of. And even if some of these politicians like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and others were young and were themselves new, they represented an era that had gone on for about 40 years or so. Right. So Trump, as a sort of pompous populist, if you will, was something fresh. He was really, there was nobody that was more of a change agent than he was. People have now been hearing the same show for 8 years. He is an incumbent retread. Now, he still may win the nomination.
He still draws. He still draws a crowd, and he still is a compelling figure. Before we completely run out of time, I want to talk about what is going on up in New Hampshire, especially on the Democratic side. Very interesting piece by the AP yesterday filed out of Laconia, where there is a lot of discontent at Joe Biden and the Democrats for trying to yank the primary schedule out from under New Hampshire. What make you of this, David Drucker?
Well, listen, it's a headache the president doesn't need. I don't think ultimately it's going to get in his way of the nomination. But look, I interviewed Governor Chris Sununu, a Republican of New Hampshire, a couple of months ago for the Dispatch. And he said, look, our law is that our primary goes first. He said that every Democrat of stature in New Hampshire is on board with this. This includes their two Democratic senators, which they still have, and the chairman of the Democratic Party in New Hampshire. And so they're going to go full steam ahead. And they're not happy to be put in this position in their own party with their own president.
David Drucker of The Dispatch, author of In Trump's Shadow, a absolute go-to guy for the next year and a half as we work our way through the primary process. Byron York, chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Dwayne. Doing well, thanks.
So we need to talk about the troubles of Pete Buttigieg. And to set that up, we have to because it's too much fun not to. Pete Buttigieg found himself on a stage with Hillary Clinton comparing troubles they have. Cut number 12, Jacob.
And, you know, one thing I'm not going to do is complain about any frustration associated with coming to an agency and having work to do every day and finding that you're dealing sometimes with a noise machine that seems to have little to do with your day-to-day work and a lot to do with perceptions about your real or perceived role in presidential politics. It would be very indecent of me to complain of that sitting next to you.
Byron York, you've got a piece today I think it came out yesterday in the Washington Examiner called The Peter Buttigieg in Perrin's Principle. I don't know who his comms team are. I don't know who advises him. I don't know where he takes his counsel from. But after the debacle in East Palestine, going to see Hillary Clinton and complain about media treatment is not exactly what I would think would be the best course of action, Byron.
I mean, saying he's not going to complain when that's all
he did
doing.
It's amazing.
Well, first of all, it's not just the train derailment and the chemical spill in East Palestine. There was the supply chain crisis. There was the meltdown Southwest Airlines. Then there was this derailment. There have been a number of incidents in which Buttigieg was disengaged, out of pocket, ham-handed, in various ways has mishandled all of these things, and he is now facing some criticism. And actually, the response of his that I focused a little bit on is he goes to CNN. He wants to talk about his problems. And he says, he kind of confesses and says, he got it wrong on the train derailment.
This is spectacular. Yes.
And he said, some of my critics, they have a point. I'm not going to say they don't have a point. And then this is what he said. It's really rich to see some of these folks, the former president, that would be Donald Trump,
right,
these Fox hosts who are literally lifelong card-carrying members of the East Coast elite, whose top economic priority has always been tax cuts for the wealthy, and who wouldn't know their way around a TJ Maxx if their life depended on it, to be presenting themselves as if they genuinely care about the forgotten middle of the country. And here it is, the kicker here. You think Tucker Carlson knows the difference between a TJ Maxx and a Kohl's? And you're shaking, you're scratching your head thinking, what is he talking about?
He's falling apart at the seams.
He's a man of the people, and he's being attacked by those East Coast elitists at Fox News, including one host who he says does not know the difference between a TJ Maxx and a Kohl's. And you ask yourself, what does that have to do with your duties as the Secretary of Transportation?
How is that of any comfort to any resident affected by the rail disaster in East Palestine or even in the western half of Pennsylvania that's affected by this?
Well, it should not only not be of comfort, it should be of great concern. You think this guy he doesn't really have our concerns at the top of his mind. And second, he doesn't really know what to do. I mean, I think that's been the biggest problem with him. The reason I called the story the Peter Buttigieg principle is some of your listeners, I'm sure, will know. In the 1960s, there was a professor. He was a business analyst. His name was Lawrence Peter, and he became famous for coming up with something called the Peter principle.
Promoted beyond the level of competence, right?
Right. The informal, yes. The way to describe it is you're in a business hierarchy. You're an employee. You do well. You're promoted. And then you do well on your new higher level job, and you're promoted again. And then it happens yet again. You're promoted. And you get promoted, finally, to a job that is beyond your abilities. And that's the one you stay in. So everybody at the organization is actually incompetent to perform the duties of the particular job that he's in. And it's only the people who are on the lower stages who actually get any work done. And Pete Buttigieg, apparently, by taking the job as Secretary of Transportation, has reached the job he can't do, which is very unfortunate for him because he wants to be president. And the whole idea of taking the Secretary of Transportation job was to give himself more executive experience on a national basis. And instead, he's kind of shown the nation that he can't handle the job.
Well, and it's compounded by the fact, Byron, that he is surrounded by people in the White House, apparently, or the extended White House administration, that don't know optics and don't know how to cover up the fact that he doesn't know what he's doing. Because right after that interview, which was not optically the best received, complaining about getting criticism by the elites, what does he do? He goes to the ultimate elite and sits on stage and says, "Mommy, make it stop."
Yeah. You know, the thing is that we all know he ran for president after having served a couple of terms as the mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
Right.
I mean, it's not exactly the kind of presidential resume that you would be looking for. But Democrats thought he was a real star. He was from the heartland. He's a smart guy. He had served in the military, had a deployment in Afghanistan. He's gay. He has a husband named Chasten, and he adopted two infant boys and went on a long parental leave. He just seemed kind of like an embodiment of Democratic social policies and ideals. And
he checks all the right identity boxes. He just doesn't have the accomplishments or the skill set.
The identity boxes are extremely important. And in all the talk about Joe Biden being too old for president and perhaps either not running for president or being forced out, who knows, lurking in the shadows, in the wings, is Pete Buttigieg, who's clearly kept his presidential ambitions alive, even as he's having trouble leading the Department of Transportation.
Oh, he's still under investigation, and he's not cooperating with requests for information, FOIA requests, Byron. He's got all sorts of problems that he's contending with.
You know, he has a penchant. He has a liking for private planes.
He certainly does. Being the man of the people.
And you know, you remember the secretary, Donald Trump's first Secretary of Health and Human Services, and I've just forgotten the name, the congressman from Georgia.
Tom Price
had to resign for taking private planes, fewer, I believe, than Pete Buttigieg has. And this has not somehow been the scandal in the national news that the Price story was, but it's true, and it is a problem for him.
We will follow that story closer in the days ahead, and we will watch Byron York and his commentary on it, because it's just too delicious to pass up. Byron of the Washington Examiner, as always, thanks for joining us. Welcome back, everybody. Dwayne Patterson filling in for Hugh this week. I am joined by a good friend of the program, Bethany Mandel, who you can read over at Deseret. Is the editor of Heroes of Liberty and the author of a brand new book that drops today, Stolen Youth. Bethany, even though Hugh's gone and I'm filling in, the Frank Luntz rules of book promotion are in full effect. In order to let people know what the book is, Stolen Youth, and where to buy the book, Stolen Youth, at Amazon, and remember to buy the book Stolen Youth, you've got to say Stolen Youth every time you can say Stolen Youth. So Bethany Mandel, author of Stolen Youth, what exactly are parents and or people going to get out of Stolen Youth if they pick up a copy of Stolen Youth?
You're very good at this, Frank Luntz game. So we wrote Stolen Youth because we saw a problem in the American sort of parenting sphere. Everywhere we turned, our children were being sort of assaulted by this woke messaging. I got two text messages yesterday that really sort of exemplify this. One was a friend who said, my daughter asked me about if she could get a chest binder and brought up the conversation of top surgery. Her daughter is in eighth grade. And it came up because she's in public school and she was told about it in health class and in the library books that she was being handed by the librarian. She was basically given the message that you're uncomfortable in your prepubescent body, what, you know, girl isn't. And the answer is, well, maybe that's not the right body for you. Maybe we can change it. So that was one text message I got. And the second text message I got was a friend who said, I can't find a theater camp that doesn't have DEI as the mission statement. There was a camp about self-identity, and she sort of read the fine print and said, I don't want my third grader to come home thinking that she's a boy at the end of it. So that was, you know, we were getting, my co-author and I, Carol Markowitz, were getting a lot of these kinds of messages and seeing a lot of these kinds of stories. And so we decided, you know, there's a book here.
I think there's going to be more than one.
Yes.
It's going to be a series because just how governments at the state level are responding to this, I think it's going to be its own book at some point. Didn't we just see yesterday Mississippi or some other state in the South just banned gender changing surgeries for minors? Didn't they just ban that?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of those kinds of bills going around, but that there's also in liberal states, California is basically a safe haven if you right. want to go as a minor to get the sex change. Even if you're not a resident of California, you can go do so in California. And there are a lot of other states that say you can't be a foster parent or an adoptive parent if you won't agree if your child comes to you and says, I was born in the wrong body. You have to give them gender-affirming care, or you can't be a foster parent or an adoptive parent. And a lot of people are waiting for the day when that becomes a child abuse issue, where if you do not affirm their gender, then you are abusing your own biological child. So, I mean, I think you're right, Dwayne. I think that there's a lot of books, but we started with Stolen Youth, and we want to sell a lot of copies and show the publishing industry that there is a market here. We ran up against wall after wall after wall, and we wrote about this in the New York Post over the weekend. The publishing industry was scared to write this because they were afraid of being canceled, even conservative imprints.
See, that's interesting to me. Who is the prototype reader that you want to pick up Stolen Youth? I know this is written for everybody to pick up. Everybody needs to get up to speed on this to realize what's happening collectively to our kids. But who is the person that you most want to reach here?
So the ideal audience for Stolen Youth is parents and grandparents. We want people to open their eyes and see this assault that's happening. We broke our book, Stolen Youth, down into several different chapters. A medical chapter, how the medical establishment is targeting your children. The entertainment industry is targeting your children. Obviously, the schools are targeting your children. And how they're targeting your children. It's not just with woke messaging, but it's also attacking their resilience. If you look at, you know, the constant headlines that Prince Harry is making, he is constantly sort of at war with his own image. He right. is bathing and basting himself in victimhood. And that's how you win points with these folks. And you strip away all resilience, and that's what they're trying to do to children. So that was another huge aspect of what we were trying to hit in Stolen Youth.
So how has media, this is book launch day. How many media hits do you have set up today? Who's trying to get in touch with it, and who's staying away from you like the plague?
So, I mean, we're making the rounds in the conservative media. We'll be on Fox several times. We were on Megyn Kelly already. We're on Dave Rubin.
Great.
The book is published. The book's Daily Wire published us, so we're on all the Daily Wire shows. But I, you know, we would like to go and have a really frank conversation on Bill Maher or The View, because this is a message that all American parents need to hear. That first mom that I talked about that told me about her daughter's chest binder and top surgery
yep.
is liberal.
See, that's the thing, is have the conversation, lefties. I know everybody in the bubble listens to this show. Have Bethany on, because it's a debate that needs to be had.
Friends, 2022 is history. But have you thought about what you will do in 2023? What will you do to make yourself better than last year? I have a challenge for you. Resolve to become a better educated citizen. Look, every year is a new opportunity, so I have a great way for you to make the most of this one. Our good friends at Hillsdale College have made their online courses free. They're all amazing, and they're free to all who wish to learn. My challenge to you, take just one. You can discover the beauty of the Bible in the Genesis story, study the writings of C.S. Lewis, or explore the true meaning of America in Constitution 101. There are many more to choose from, and these are all self-paced, free courses featuring Hillsdale faculty and scholars. So visit hughforhillsdale.com, that's HUGHFORHillsdale.com, and just pick one of the more than 30 free Hillsdale courses. I hope you accept my challenge. Pick whichever course you'd like and resolve to be a more educated American in 2023. Go to hughforhillsdale.com. Start your free course today. Take it away, my friend.
Thanks, Hugh. Hour three of the Hugh Hewitt Show begins with a conversation with Molly Hemingway, the editor-in-chief of The Federalist. A conversation I've been looking forward to all morning. Good morning, Molly. Welcome. Good to have you here. There is a thousand things that I could talk to you about, but everything that is in your pile this morning that I want to cover happens to be dealing with the media bubble, and I got to run stuff by and get your take on it. Let's start with the story over the last day or two, which is this domestic terrorist attack at a police depot outside of Atlanta. And without getting your take on it initially, I want you to react to Nora O'Donnell's take on it on the CBS Evening News last night. Jacob, can we play cut 24 for her?
Tonight, 23 people are charged with domestic terrorism after a violent protest at the site of a planned police and fire training facility near Atlanta. Activists dressed all in black attacked the construction site and officers late Sunday with fireworks, Molotov cocktails, rocks, and bricks. The police chief says many of those arrested were from outside Atlanta and their goal was anarchy.
Now, while that was going on, simultaneously over on ABC's World News Tonight, they had this report filed, cut 25.
And tonight, some protesters accusing police in this latest incident of violating civil rights, saying in part that this, quote, reaffirms that this cop training facility should never be built.
And David, only two of those charged are from Georgia, the rest out of state, and two people even from different countries. And David, city council overwhelmingly voted in favor of that training facility, both Republicans and Democrats in support. David.
Now, Molly Hemingway, I can't quite put my finger on it, but there seems to be something missing from those reports. Can you help enlighten the audience of what salient point may be missing from this story?
Well, there's so much missing from this story.
I know.
These things have been going on for months, first off, and the type of tolerance that we see for this kind of left-wing violence is crazy. There were some interesting arrests. You know, they're mentioning details about the arrests, but not mentioning that someone from the Southern Poverty Law Center was arrested for participating in these violent protests.
You mean those people that are counseling the FBI on who to target, those guys?
Yeah, this group that goes and tells people who are terrorists in America apparently had someone there. They actually defended his participation there. They claimed that it was just, you know, legal representation, that he should not have been arrested. You know, we'll have to wait and see what the details are. But it's so interesting that this group that was also responsible for the memo, they were the source for the memo that traditional Catholics are terrorists.
Yep.
That became quite newsworthy.
The rad trads, right?
And they've previously had people taking part in Antifa riots and protests. And they are frequently used as a source by the FBI and other groups to determine, you know, who is good and who is bad. And they never should have been doing this because for years now, unfortunately, the Southern Poverty Law Center has become a radical, extreme group, including that they were the people that posted a map that helped another terrorist locate the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely.
Where he came to shoot everybody up and ended up shooting, only being able to shoot the
security guard, right.
Who took care of the situation.
Absolutely. Next media story for Molly Hemingway. CNN staff ordered to ignore the lab leak because it sounded like a Trump talking point. This is Spencer Brown writing for our sister site over at Town Hall. The order to not run down leads related to a lab leak in China came, according to fresh reporting from Fox News Digital, from the Facts First Network's then-president Jeff Zucker. His reasoning? It was a Trump talking point. Molly Hemingway.
I mean, it's great when you get acknowledgement of what we've seen at CNN for years now, which is they weren't reporting the news. They were reporting narrative and propaganda based on who they thought it would help and who they thought it would hurt. And we've had a lot of people admit that they were not covering the very understandable theory that this was a lab leak because they thought it would help Trump, and they wanted to do anything in their power to hurt him, including helping Chinese communists with their propaganda that led to the deaths of millions of people.
In the Washington Post, there is an op-ed today by a guy named Kevin Blackstone, which is calling for Major League Baseball to expand on what they did in Georgia to Florida because apparently, they don't like Florida's politics, so they think that Major League Baseball should pull up stakes and, I guess, what, not have spring training there, Molly?
Oh, Dwayne, this one hits me very personally because I was a lifelong Major League Baseball fan until they boycotted the state of Georgia to protest that Georgia made some slight improvements to their election security and election.
Cost them $1 billion, right?
Yes, and so now this Yahoo is being published in the Washington Post saying that Major League Baseball should repeat their grievous error that did so much to damage their relationship with their fan base by also waging an economic boycott of Florida. And I also just want to remind people, it was President Biden himself who called on corporations to do an economic boycott against the people of Georgia because he did not want election integrity in that state.
Back to the lab leak story, just for a second, because there was a little bit of fun that came out of Bill Maher's program on HBO. On his panel Friday night, one of the panelists was John Heilman over on MSNBC. And when they were talking about the lab leak theory, Heilman got put on the spot and said, well, I've always taken this seriously. Except our friends at Fox News have a bit of video from the pandemic where the same John Heilman says that anybody who looks at COVID as a lab leak is engaging in a conspiracy theory. Molly.
I love when there is tape evidence.
Isn't it just
lying.
Grand?
But I've always viewed this as a bit of an intelligence test. Like, the idea that you had to come up with this crazy idea that it was a bat or a pangolin when there was the Wuhan Institute of Virology in Wuhan that was investigating coronavirus and how to do gain of function and doing gain of function research on it. Like, it's an IQ test whether or not you thought that was a reasonable theory or not. And pretty much the entire media class failed that IQ test because they wanted to hurt their political opponents.
Now, this next story is an actual legitimate tragic story. A former White House official dies of injuries after a business jet she was on hit turbulence. This is a Michael Laris story. A former White House and international development official died last week after the business jet she was flying in hit severe turbulence in New England, officials said Monday. Her name is Dana Hyde. She was flying with her husband and one of her sons on an aircraft owned by a rural broadband consulting firm, Connexon, the company said. And it's a tragic story. And prayers for her family. You know, this is that there's no fun to be had out of this, except if you looked online at the Washington Post, right below the title of the story, former White House official dies of injuries, by Michael Laris, right below that it says, more coverage. Climate change is raising flight turbulence risks. Here's what to know. Molly, they never miss an opportunity. Ever.
That's amazing. I didn't even know about that. But it's almost like a religion for these people. And it's just, I don't even know what to say about it.
I mean, the family has just coming to grips with a sudden loss of their mom. And the Washington Post is, see, this is all because of climate change's fault. Here's what you need to know about climate change. I mean, it's like Rahm Emanuel is actually running the world.
Well, he is in a way, and he's definitely running the media because so much of our corporate media, unfortunately, view their job as information warfare, constantly pushing a narrative and propaganda. It would be a waste for the Washington Post, in their mind, to run a story without also pushing their political agenda at the same time. And so we get very, you know, just an inability to be human and normal because politics becomes so important for these people.
There is a quick pushback, you know, just quick 30-second reaction. The Los Angeles Times ran a piece about John Oliver going after Ron DeSantis as a petty autocrat and bully. And in filing their piece, they asked for comment from the Ron DeSantis team. They asked Brian Griffin, the press secretary, to respond, and they said that he didn't respond. Well, he did. His response is, John Oliver is irrelevant. They chose to ignore the response and just said they didn't respond, Molly. Quickly, 10 seconds.
They lied. It's wrong. But Ron DeSantis' team is treating the media as they deserve to be treated.
And publicizing the exchange. Molly Hemingway of the Federalist, thank you very much. 33 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, America. Dwayne Patterson in for Hugh all this week. I am fortunate to be joined by Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, one of our very good friends of the program. going all the way back to him as a candidate for Congress. That's how far back his appearances run. Senator Cotton, good to have you on with Dwayne this time.
Hey, Dwayne, it's good to be on with you. And it has been a very long time since I've been coming on the show. And, you know, for that whole time, I've always heard you talk about what the show would be like if he only had a producer. And now the truth can be told about how great the show would be if only Dwayne had on-air talent to match his abilities. Right?
If only Dwayne had a host. That's the real statement. That's exactly right.
Reminds me a little bit of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in Airplane when the kid's dad criticized him for not working hard enough, and Kareem said, "Why don't you try dragging Walton into the airport for 48 minutes? dragging Hugh Hewitt for 25 years."
That's
remarkable what you can do. Spread your own wings.
That's exactly right. Some very serious stuff to talk about in our time together. I want to begin with, as Washington seems to go, there is a difference of opinion on all sorts of different subjects. But I want to play two different views on what the U.S. policy should be towards tech in regards to the CCP, and here is the left's viewpoint espoused by Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo on CNBC yesterday, Cut 16.
The goal is not to be self-sufficient. That is absolutely not the goal. We won't achieve that. We will forever be buying chips from Taiwan, from Korea, from Europe.
Okay, stop right there. We don't even have that as a goal. We don't even want to try to become self-sufficient when it comes to chips and tech. Our mutual friend Robert C. O'Brien, the ambassador extraordinaire, the former national security advisor for Donald Trump, has a very important piece he authored in The Hill this morning. A strong tech sector will keep Xi Jinping from fulfilling his Chinese dream. That seems to be a little different viewpoint than what we heard from Secretary Raimondo. Where does Senator Cotton come down on this?
Well, a lot closer to Robert O'Brien. The key thing is that we be independent of Chinese influence and leverage. In many cases right now, Dwayne, China has America over a barrel. And it's not just in high tech goods. It's also in relatively low-tech, very traditional things like acetaminophen and ibuprofen and penicillin and other life-saving drugs, or as we learned at the beginning of the pandemic, various kinds of medical equipment and protective devices. On anything that is a threat to American health or safety, we cannot be dependent on China. We'd like to be totally resilient and self-sufficient, but at a minimum, we can't be dependent on China.
Wall Street Journal, staying on the CCP, Wall Street Journal reporting last night that the CCP Secretary General Xi Jinping issued an unusually blunt rebuke of U.S. policy on Monday, blaming what he termed a Washington-led campaign to suppress China for recent challenges facing his country. Quote, "Western countries led by the U.S. have implemented all-around containment, encirclement, and suppression against us, bringing unprecedentedly severe challenges to our country's development," end quote. Mr. Xi was quoted by state media saying on Monday. His comments marked an unusual departure for a leader who has generally refrained from directly criticizing the U.S. in public remarks, even as his decade-long leadership has demonstrated a pessimistic view of the bilateral relationship. Senator Cotton, I wouldn't imagine you would have something to say about that.
If only we had effectively contained Chinese communists, Wayne. But I think what Xi is expressing there is frustration at the failures of his own policies. You know, for many decades, going back to the 1980s under Deng Xiaoping, Chinese communists tried to import market-based reforms so they could have the economic growth that comes from capitalism, but still have it under the thumb of Chinese communism while funding their aggressive military buildup. Over the last 10 years, though, Xi has brought a lot of those businesses to heel, you know, as evidenced by his treatment of Jack Ma, the formerly famous Chinese billionaire. And now you're starting to see China growth stagnate because of the corruption, state-owned enterprises, state-influenced-directed enterprises, the way they allocate credit through loans to politically favored enterprises or regions in China, or just look at his COVID-zero policy, which he pursued until last November. I mean, it made Gavin Newsom and Andrew Cuomo look like Ron DeSantis or Brian Kemp in its insane adherence to a COVID lockdown policy that had long since proven counterproductive. So I think Xi is in large part expressing frustration with the failures of his own policies, poking them in anti-American rhetoric.
That's probably pretty close to where I'm coming down on this too. Also in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, a huge piece by Michael Gordon. The U.S. is not yet ready for the era of great power conflict. Since 2018, the military has shifted to focus on China and Russia after decades fighting insurgencies, but it still faces challenges to produce weapons and come up with new ways of waging war. Tom Cotton, what are we going to do about it, and when are we going to finally get serious about building up the military and the industrial complex?
Dwayne, I'm really worried that we aren't prepared to fight a major conflict. In all likelihood, that conflict would be against China after it tries to invade Taiwan.
Of course.
I've heard a lot over the last year from Pentagon officials who are celebrating the fact that we've moved from, say, a 3 or 4 year timeline for producing munitions to, say, 18 months. That's just not acceptable. It's good. It's moving in the right direction, but you know, we need to get that timeline down to 2 or 3 months. And there's a lot of work to be done by the Pentagon in the defense industrial base, not just with prime contractors like Raytheon or Lockheed, but with the subcontractors, people that are providing the chips and the gaskets and the valves and the ball bearings and the electronics and the energetics. We have to rebuild that defense industrial base. And there's obviously a large demand for it, not just to restock American weapons, but also to sell to our friends in places like Ukraine and Taiwan and NATO countries and Israel, Saudi Arabia, Australia, and so forth. It has to be an urgent priority. It's certainly one of my top priorities in this year's defense legislation that we work on every single year.
Dwayne Patterson filling in for Hugh, speaking with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. Up north, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, has ordered a probe of alleged Chinese interference in the most recent Canadian election. Now, Senator, I'm aghast that the CCP would interfere in another country's election so close to our own when, if you ask the left, they haven't had any noticeable interference in our own elections. I'm curious as to why they would pick on Canada and not target us.
Well, Dwayne, obviously communists of all stripes, whether they were Russian or now Chinese, make it a habit to meddle in the internal politics of free societies. Remember in the early 1980s, the major nuclear freeze movement and the effort to keep Ronald Reagan and Western European leaders from deploying cruise missiles to Europe. That was funded in no small part by the KGB. If you've seen advertisements or been subjected to a campaign against hydraulic fracturing, the great technology unlocks so much oil and gas, that's funded in no small part by Vladimir Putin's intelligence services. So no one should be surprised that communists, whether they're in China or Russia or Cuba or elsewhere, are trying to meddle in the politics of democratic societies. What is surprising is that the liberal ideologues here in Washington, D.C., have actually invited foreign election meddling by extending the vote to any non-citizen in the United States. You know, that's often characterized, or in the District of Columbia, that's often characterized as letting illegal aliens vote, which it would, but it's also going to let diplomats working on the Chinese embassy, which is, say, mostly spies, vote in D.C. city council elections. If you thought their laws were bad now, just wait until a bunch of spies from Russia and China and Cuba can vote in their elections.
That's exactly right. I know it's, by the way, just quick side question. I know it's the other end of the building, and it's not typically your concern as far as how the House runs their business, but I'm sure you've observed the Select Committee on China as it's been stood up by our friend Mike Gallagher. What do you make of the committee thus far?
Well, I commend Mike Gallagher for the work in that committee. He's got a great group of members, who include a lot of Democrats who take this threat seriously. Not all of them have stuck their head in the sand about the threat from Chinese communists. I know that Mike Gallagher is committed to trying to have a serious and hopefully bipartisan run on the committee to highlight the dangers that Chinese communists pose to our country, whether it's taking jobs in factories or threatening the privacy and security of your kids through Trojan horses like TikTok or gobbling up farmland, especially farmland right next to military bases. So I'm glad that Speaker McCarthy created this committee and appointed an outstanding chairman, Mike Gallagher, to elevate and highlight the threats that Chinese communists pose to America.
Last story I want to bring to your attention this week is from Lawrence Norman over at the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. and its European allies have split over the response to Iran's production of near-weapons-grade uranium, with Britain, France, and Germany favoring a public censure of Tehran, while the Biden administration is reluctant to even do that, according to diplomats involved in the discussions. Senator Cotton, the French are more robust against the Iranians than we are.
Isn't it remarkable, Dwayne? I mean, when you've got the French to your right on national security, you might want to reassess your strategy.
You see, I'm thinking, yeah.
This is not a surprise, though, Dwayne. Remember, in 2013, as Barack Obama and John Kerry were finalizing the preliminary nuclear deal with Iran, it was, again, the French who were trying to pump the brakes, trying to demand more safeguards, trying to put in more guardrails around this deal. And they did it again in 2015 when Barack Obama and John Kerry finalized the nuclear deal. This is a consistent pattern of Barack Obama, Joe Biden, and the Democrats always looking the other way with Iran. All that does is embolden Iran to go for broke. They've almost enriched enough uranium to create a nuclear weapon. That happened mostly on Joe Biden's watch, not on Donald Trump's watch, because they know they can get away with it. Whereas Donald Trump and Republicans will kill their terrorist mastermind, Qasem Soleimani, and stand up to all of their wrongdoing against us and our friends. Joe Biden and Democrats always turn the other cheek.
But Tom Cotton, 20 seconds, the White House has given up on the Iran deal. There's no way it's going to happen. Why are they still doing this?
Well, they haven't given up on it because they give up on it, they have to articulate another policy. So they'll continue to pretend that maybe they can get back into it, which is a policy of Iran getting a nuclear weapon.
Senator Tom Cotton, thank you very much. As always, we will be back next week with Senator Cotton and Hugh and some producer that's in the background being maligned again.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.